Well, thank you all for being here. I'm happy to have the opportunity to be here with you guys. It's when Jonathan asked me to give this talk, it was really surprising because I began to think about how things are different now than they were 12 years ago at the Nottingham Conference, and everything's changed, everything. One thing that came out of Nottingham was we still had people, good scholars, saying you can't yet say anything critically about holography because the medium hasn't developed yet. There wasn't any kind of holographic vocabulary yet, and that didn't seem to make sense at the time because we saw in the holographers who were there all these really, really strong conceptual pieces that did have their own language, certainly conceptual language, and there wasn't anything in the holograms themselves that precluded any kind of formal discussion of them. So it was a really, really odd situation. But what was one of the fundamental things that was lacking then was a critical dialogue around other new media that would sort of set the stage or help holography along, or help the discussion of holography along. Holography was very much on its own. I think conceptually it was quite far advanced compared to a lot of the things people were doing in digital art at that point, back when they called it digital art. So now what has happened in the intervening years? Huge change in education, huge change in the demands of conceptual artists, huge change in theory and criticism. In the mid-90s, I've been thinking that, at least the situation in the United States, was that very, very few people were reading continental theory, cultural theory like Baudrillard and Umberto Eco and Deleuze, and people like that who talk about holograms and they talk about hyperreality. If you did learn about those things in your cultural theory courses in the mid-90s, you got them in graduate school, you didn't get them as undergraduates. What's changed now is that if you're an art major, focusing on new media in a college or university, not even an art school, you're exposed to the concept of the simulacrum. You're exposed to these concepts that should have been, that would have made holography a lot more understandable had people, had critics, had curators all been aware of these concepts. So that now, as in the Museum of Holography, the MIT Museum, a few weeks ago, following a bunch of college students around, and they were, you know, they were bringing up these ideas. They weren't quite sure about what they were talking about, but they were familiar with the notion, many of the ideas underlying postmodernism or posthumanism, that what they are seeing around them or what they prefer to see is mediated, whether it's through TV or, you know, YouTube, whatever. And that often, not only is that a preferred way to experience the world, but it's often, you know, considered more real than an actual experience. So this is one of the central ideas of postmodernism, and theorists like Baudrillard use holography as a metaphor for this, as sort of the perfect example. And I suppose this sort of theoretical movement has gone through two generations now, since 12 years ago. So the perfect simulacra that Baudrillard would have been talking about would have been something like Kant's, or these amazing French pieces, where there's the sense that the simulation is so perfect that in our understanding of the simulation, the real object disappears, or is somehow destroyed, or our concept of it disappears, or becomes not important. Holography fits perfect, and that's perfect. Sort of use of holography. Now, digitally, the world has advanced. And the idea of posthumanism, a world that's, you know, sort of post our physical experience of the world, has moved on to embrace the concept that, yes, what we see around us is simulation, but there never was a reality. That is, and this is mainly through the understanding of digital space and net art and things like that, that we're referring to things that never existed in the real world, and that's now the reality of like what our college students have grown up with. So it's a really, really interesting critical and theoretical time for holography to sort of be enjoying this rebirth. Now, so I suppose for the paper, what I want to do is think about the kinds of problems holography continues to encounter and will continue to encounter, and what questions museum displays pose for holography today, and what questions holography poses to the viewer that are different than, you know, 10, 12, 15 years ago. I'm showing you, actually, this is really sort of dim image. This is from the Musion website, Musion Eyeliner, which is making holograms. of, and actually they're the perfect hologram for the digital sort of second generation post-humanism, in that this is a band called X-Japan, which was, you know, one of the most important Japanese bands, very, very influential. They broke up very famously 10 years ago, and their very charismatic lead guitarist, Hide, killed himself, unfortunately. But as bands do, they wanted a reunion last spring, and so to do that, they needed their most charismatic member. So they commissioned a hologram of Hide to be on stage with them. And I guess when he first appeared, he was a little dim in black and white, but eventually he appeared in full color. And this is almost the perfect example of the new post-humanism, because he, first of all, he's not a hologram, he's just a projection system, but he's, you know, approximately the right size and shape, and he's in motion, and he's playing the guitar to a recorded track. And to the generation who was at this concert, they were young enough to never have seen the band originally. I mean, these guys are all in their 40s now. The girls in the audience were all like 15. So this is real to them. They never experienced the original, right? So it's just as real as, you know, the original would have been. So it's a really sort of fascinating thing. But what we have now, though, is holography, the name usurped and applied to anything that fits our idea of what a hologram should be. And 12 years ago, that really, really would have irritated me. But I think now, looking at it from a sort of cultural theory perspective, this is opening up a whole line of conversation for artists and other holographers, because it's many holograms would be more in a dialogue with something like this than they would be with other holograms. And this we see in a lot of artworks as well. That I don't want to skip that for now because I keep changing my PowerPoint. Sorry. This is what we see in large shows, and I'm not referring to Jonathan's shows or Matthias's shows, because if you think back to many of the very, very large-scale holography shows from past eras, the juxtaposition of the art and the commercial and the scientific was really disorienting for the viewer. And there wasn't necessarily much explanation as to what the intent was of the holographer. And clearly, when we look at the art that was in many of those shows, the context for those artworks, those art holograms, was really not within any sort of holography dialogue. It was within other conversations in the art world at large. So I think even today, when most art holography does have more to do with the larger art world than an internal discussion among holographers. So the critical and theoretical world has really changed. Now, also, I think certainly the students have changed. The students in the audience, they're much more aware of things. The curators are much more aware of things. Curators now want to be, and I know, I don't want to generalize, but I think I'm finding them much more savvy and wanting to have something to sink their teeth in. They want to be able to write about what they're showing. And they need either, you know, some sort of conceptual or theoretical or critical hook that I don't know if they asked for in past years, but it would have, you know, probably helped holography. Students, who are going to be the new holographers? There's such a conceptual grounding in most art programs today, and it's expanding. You get fewer and fewer Bauhaus-driven art schools nowadays, much more conceptually driven. These are art students who are going out to solve problems. They have a concept, they want to express it. They will look to any medium that will solve that problem for them. It's not just, I think the people who first got into holography were coming from often traditional mediums and loved holography and wanted to see what they could do with it. They weren't necessarily approaching it, the medium, with an outside problem to conquer. And I think that focus will change, you know, what kind of work we see produced in holography. So I spent some time at the MIT Museum the last few weeks or months, because it's a really interesting show, and one of the things I wanted to think about was, in what ways is there some sort of intrinsic language to holography that, or is there? Is there anything, do holograms actually speak to one another, or are we just imagining they do because it's all the same medium? And the MIT show is really, really interesting, because MIT has is unusually constricted in its mission, because it's got the Museum of Holography collection, many other holograms. But it also, so it wants to show the technology because it's the MIT Museum, but it also has to make a connection to MIT through this exhibition of holography. So we see at the MIT collection, which is actually now quite a small room of about six walls of holograms, with a very, very small didactic label saying this is the most comprehensive and most and largest holography collection in the world, and then describing the amazing sort of mimetic qualities of the holograms themselves, texture and things like that. So very, very simple, nothing conceptual, very, very simple. But then you're confronted, so you're not given any sort of framework for entering the show. And so it becomes, within in that setting, a very, very sort of conceptually, barren experience, which is very interesting, because then you can focus on what you're actually getting from the works themselves. And even in the context, you enter the holography room. Who's been there recently to the MIT? Anybody? Okay. It used to be a much larger room where there'd be a permanent collection and then some changing exhibitions. Now it's a much smaller room. And you enter, usually you'll have either gone to the robotic wing or the Harold Edgerton wing, plus the sculptor in residence who does these really cool mechanical interactive things. Now all these shows are very heavily didactically described. The importance of the robotics, the importance of Edgerton's work, all these things, lots of material, lots of information at you. You enter the holography rooms and there's nothing. There's just the holograms. And it's very, very dark too, with just the holograms lit. So it's a very, very different experience compared to the whole rest of the museum. So what does the, and I'm going to sound like I'm slamming the show, but I'm not, because I think it's actually very interesting, but it doesn't, I don't know if it actually does what it's trying to do. When you enter the exhibition, you have four white light transmission holograms hanging in space, and a lot of you will be really familiar with these. We've got Setsuko Ishii, Steve Benton, and two Rudy Burkhouts. And they're there. They're beautifully lit. They're in space. You have little children running around and batting them, so they're swinging, which is just a little nerve-wracking. But that, you know, they make sense together in that visual, in that they all have some visual qualities in common. They have similar coloration. They have similar sort of spatial orientation. They're abstract. So in terms of illustrating the comprehensiveness of, well, you can see what this display means. It's, you know, what can you do with this kind of hologram? What kind of space can you create? What kind of colors can you create? Very, very simple. But the show becomes increasingly incoherent, and in a really interesting way, actually. Most people that I saw, if you weren't with little kids, would start off with the wall I just showed you, and then they'd often turn back, read the didactic material, and turn and start walking the wall across from the white light transmission holograms. They tended, if they started with the didactic material, to walk from right to left. So we start with a Marie-Andre Cosette hologram. We have a John Kaufman, the National Geographic, and is that Jody Burns? Jody Burns telescope that you look through, and I hope I'm right on that. Cherry? Cherry, I'm sorry, Greg Cherry, I'm sorry. Brain cramp. Now, they're really, really interesting. Because it's hard to know. With the coherence of the white light transmission display, we have a sense of what these holograms are asking us to figure out. With the, let me just skip, where am I? Oh, this is an older. Actually, okay, I'll go with this PowerPoint. Let me just describe the four walls first. No, I won't, I'll go. I'm sorry, I'm just gonna skip. Start with this wall. Now, Marie-Andre Cosette, this seems to be, you know, you're confronted with this image, and it's a very strange little image, and it's not necessarily one of her best holograms. And actually, in person, it's quite small, and it's actually really, really skillfully colored. It's in various shades of beige and white, so very difficult to do. But what it seems to be is an accumulation of objects, mostly virtual. The latter sticks out a little bit, of objects taken from either like a budgie cage or a fish tank, things like this, you know, funny little household objects, with no reason to be memorialized in a hologram. You know, it's clearly a commercial image, or just designed to show off, you know, the control of color and texture. So the wooden ladder looks wooden, the sandcastle in the middle is sort of sand-colored and grainy, and you really catch the texture. And that's a white sort of plaster mask in the background, which really does read as white. So it's a, you know, there's you know, skill there. But the subject matter is so amazingly vacant that it can be a little perplexing, and people tend to pass over it quite quickly. Now, John Kaufman's, on the other hand, this is called Stone House, or Stone Room, rather, is very, very dimly lit, and usually his holograms are quite intense, and this is a real disappointment. But also, I think it's there to show texture. I think this waltz begins as a formal display of what holography can do, but it's really hard to tell. Because really, these end up looking like kind of desiccated waffles. They don't look like stone at all. They just look strange, and they're very, very dim, so you peer into this murkiness and try to make something out of it. Unlike, you know, his actual holograms of stones that are quite legible and communicate clearly and are interestingly ambiguous and, you know, give you a lot to think about. Then you move to the National Geographic cover. You can see already how disorienting this is, because as you, as the viewer, you're trying to figure out what you're being told to, what you're being taught from this. So this is sort of a jolt, and you've got the laser, a splendid light for man's use, and, you know, a very American little eagle. So there's that, and then you move to Greg Cherry's telescope, which is also an interesting, also, you know, a lot of finesse there. You look through the telescope, and you see, you know, a very strange two-dimensional drawing that looks like it's almost from like a middle school textbook, with, you know, seen from outer space, a moonscape, little spaceships, things like that. So it's clever. But, you know, when you look at the four holograms together across from the white light transmission holograms, the walls don't seem to, they don't have the same purpose. The white light transmission holograms clearly have some sort of dialogue, even if they have different intents. Formally, these do not. They're bizarre. It's a bizarre combination. Now, the most disorienting is this next wall, which is almost a, you know, a shocking jolt. You have Patrick Boyd's Bardas Takes the Downtrain, which you read from right to left. So you've proceeded past Greg Cherry's, and now you're turning the corner. And then you have Fritz Goro, a, you know, nice, crisp reflection hologram of these objects. Now, Fritz Goro is, you know, an amazing photographer, a nature photographer, a science photographer, and he's got MIT connections. That's great, but there's no reason for, of all the holograms in the collection, for this to be there, really. I'm sounding snarky, but he makes really boring holograms, and I think he was experimenting with the media, and that's about it. And so when you have those two together, you know, what is the audience reading from this? You've got Patrick Boyd, who fits with, you know, today he reads very well, and you can apply all sorts of kind cinematic theory, all sorts of visual, you know, cultural theory to his work, and it works. This, the Goro hologram, invites nothing like that. You know, it's a very sort of banal image. So you begin to just become increasingly disoriented, but what becomes more and more apparent as you walk through the show is that these images are not really communicating on any level. What do they have in common? They have some illusionism. They do force the viewer to move and interact in a certain way, but that doesn't really reach a conceptual level with any of the holograms. And then there's you sort of turn the corner into the white light transmissions with the, this is the Jody Burns molecule. So here are the three together, which is a really odd juxtaposition. Okay, sorry, I'm a bit out of order here. Let me go back to the, sorry, I changed this so many times, I shouldn't have done that. So, what visual language is occurring here? Sorry. Now, let me go to the portrait wall. There's a very interesting portrait wall, which looks like this. Basically, I've sandwiched them a little bit closely together. They're actually spread out and well hung. But we've got the portrait of Yuri Denisyuk, Margaret Benyon's Tie Girl, portrait of Keith Haring, and then a portrait of Harold Edgerton. And you are walking from left to right when you see these. And Denisyuk makes sense. He's looking out at you. He's mostly virtual. Tie Girl is totally virtual. You've got an interaction between the face and the surface pattern of the tiger. It's very interesting. Keith Haring is actually quite, he's in real space, he seems to be sticking his head in a funny way through the glass plate. So you have, if the museum is intending to give you an understanding of what you can do with portrait holography and give the viewer very different images to respond to, you know, it works. Then you get to the Edgerton image, and it's a small stereogram, and very, very strange in that it's warped, it's in bad shape. It's warped at the bottom, so that as you move across it, there's not much parallax. You move across, and it's very warped at the bottom, so it looks like someone's pulling his tie as you move across it. So it almost seems like a joke at first. But there's no reason for it to be there, because it's really in bad shape, except that there's an Edgerton collection, a connection to MIT, of course. So that's very, that connection has been made. Now, let's go to the four there. I'm just giving an idea of what curators are thinking about when they're confronted with some of the strange juxtapositions we get in holography. You have another wall here again, which is weird, which is the skulls on the left, which are kind of cool because you walk past and the side of the skull disappears and you can see inside. Then you've got Melissa Crenshaw's very, very dimly lit hologram of light bars in the center, and then another Fritz Goro image for Life magazine, which is a deep space image, which really doesn't do much except, again, put geometric forms in space and things like the word holography. These are not communicating much, many of these. And a lot of it has to do with context. Now, the thing that's different about the shows that are circulating now, like Jonathan's, is that when you look at the show, there is an organization. You may have art and commercial and scientific holography there together, but they're arranged in a way that there's some sort of communication among the works. Now, did I talk about I think we're on the way to solving the curatorial issues, especially with the change in criticism. When the Windows show was advertised for the MIT Museum, and has everybody seen that call for work, most of you? Can't tell. No? Okay, well, there's a call for work for the MIT Museum, which has these wonderful windows now, and it's been remodeled. And call for a holography show to be put in these windows. And at first I thought, oh God, no, it's going to be like this. It's going to be all sorts of different kinds of holograms pushed together, which ultimately will drain holography. The holograms that do have a conceptual context that will be drained away by these weird juxtapositions. But in fact, that's reading the small print, no. The curator was very, very careful, and I think it's Seth. Are you still here? There you are. Yeah. To very explicitly say he's displaying the holograms as a cultural medium. And that immediately suggests to most artists in new media that there's a very specific conceptual context that doesn't necessarily go with art, doesn't necessarily go with science, it doesn't necessarily go with commercial holography, but it's studying the medium as it functions within the culture. And that's a way to transcend all these difficulties we've had with the nebulousness of holography within a sort of critical framework. So I think it's going to be a wonderful show. And I don't know what you've probably had lots of submissions, the deadlines. I'm curious as to whether you got I should have asked you before.
Yeah. That was the plan from the beginning. We are in the process of trying to work out the loan, which has not been an easy one.
Yeah, it'd be wonderful. It would be a wonderful sort of full circle kind of experience. So, just in conclusion, there is nothing inherently in holography that insists that it should be exhibited. Holograms should be exhibited together unless that was the intent of the maker. I mean, there doesn't seem to be, there's a general formal language, but it's not unique to holography. It's addressing things that are found in new media, traditional media, other media. And I think in many exhibitions, in trying to make the exhibition coherent, we end up making it incoherent because there's no, you know, there's no supporting foundation beyond the medium, which is you know, was gone by the 1960s. This idea of a medium-specific world. So obviously, I'm just raising questions about this, and I haven't come to any kind of conclusions yet. And so what I'm hoping is that during this year, before we all end up in China together, hopefully that maybe we can start a dialogue on this, and I'd love to hear your responses and your opinions on some of these things. Any questions? Nope? Okay. Thanks.